Skeptic Forum in Pritchard Hall on Sunday, on April 30th, is going to be Jeff Zwirnik. And you guys probably remember him. He was here about two, three months ago. He's the newest, latest scholar at RTV. So it'll be another reason to come and hear him answer questions for a couple hours. So that ought to be fun. I'm starting to get an email from Reasons to Believe every couple of weeks that tells me what everybody's doing, so I can kind of fill you guys in. And the scholars at RTB are getting busier and busier, which is cool. We all like to see that. It means Hugh isn't here quite as much, but he tries very hard not to plan too many things on his Sundays. So let me go through a couple of these things. A lot of this is just for your own information, but let's not forget to pray. These people need our prayers. They're experts. They're scholars. They do this all the time. But you know what? To really reach these people that they're talking to, and for them, frankly, to go into it with the right humility and the right attitude, they need your prayer. So keep that in mind as I say these. Dr. Fuzz Rana spoke at Willow Creek Community Church outside of Chicago February 4th. At the evening event, there were 1,500 people. The pastor that's in charge of that event at Willow Creek said that he wants to have RTV back every year. So that's, and you, as you guys know, that's a huge, huge church. Fuzz has a total of 26 speaking engagements at various outreaches through the middle of this month. So he's doing 26 speaking engagements in probably less than 3 weeks. So, and he's sick. So, again, please pray for him. Hugh spoke before 1,000 people at the Charleston Southern University convocation on February 8th, just a few days ago. Hugh's new book on the testable creation model has made its way to NAV Press for further editing. No title has been agreed on yet. It will be coming back this month to RTV for further editorial work. The release date is looking like middle of September this year. One thing to keep in mind here, financial contributions to RTV were for last year were a little under the previous year's total. Nevertheless, the amount contributed was very encouraging. We now have 1,650 message of the month members, which has become a great source to raise funds for the ministry. How many people know what message of the month is? Okay, for those of you who don't know what it is, or know what it is and aren't doing it, every month, Hugh or Fuzz or Jeff or Ken or Dave gives a talk on a particular subject of interest that is only available through Message of the Month subscribers. And it comes out on, I believe, CD and MP3, is that right? And it's a subscription. It's something that you subscribe to. So I believe it's $30 a month now. It's a great source of income for Reasons, and it's something that you could do to support the ministry. So if you're not doing it, I really suggest that you consider it. It really is a good thing for them. It's working out really well. Yes? Yeah, okay, good. Thank you, Lee. It is. Good. How many people saw yesterday's LA Times? Left-hand column one, you know how they do those articles of general importance that aren't particularly daily news events. It's titled, Their Own Vision Version of a Big Bang. The gentleman who just got through debating Hugh, Ken Ham, he is the founder of Answers in Genesis, the leading young earth creationist organization. And I just want to read you the first few paragraphs, and I don't want to comment on it. I'll let you comment. Refrain. LA Times yesterday. Evangelist Ken Ham smiled at the 2,300 elementary students packed into pews, their faces wrapped. With dinosaur puppets and silly cartoons, he was training them to reject much of geology, paleontology, and evolutionary biology as a sinister tangle of lies. Boys and girls, Ham said, if a teacher so much as mentions evolution, or the Big Bang, or an era when dinosaurs ruled the earth, you put your hand up and you say, excuse me, were you there? Can you remember that? The children roared their assent. Sometimes people will answer no, but you weren't there either, Ham told them. Then you say, no, I wasn't, but I know someone who was, and I have his book about the history of the world. He waved his Bible in the air. Who's the only one who's always been there? Ham asked. God, the boys and girls shouted. Who's the only one who knows everything? God. So who should you always trust, God or the scientists? So, this is, well, I'm not going to say anything. Yes. Good. Yeah, that's good. I'd like to see that one when we're done. Okay, anybody who wants to read the whole article can, yesterday, Saturday's LA Times. I'll leave it on the table over here. Wayne, New Jersey. It could be. Yeah. Okay, I'll put this over. I don't get a chance to talk to this class very often, but I'm really excited. Well, other than, yes, Mara. Science, no threat to faith, Pope says. Yeah. Right. That's why I want to read this and dissect it, and then next week I'll say something about it. I'm really excited to do this. I get to get up in front of you guys every week and do announcements, and once in a while I get to say something that I think. But to have the whole class is a real treat. I've been doing a lot of reading. I've been through the apologist course at Reasons. Most of you know that. But I got a hold of a couple of ideas the last two or three months that really turned me on and really got me excited. And I thought, right away I said, I want to teach this. I want to talk to the class about it because it's some real common sense, easy to understand once you get it. Now, it's going to take a little wrapping your mind around it to do this, but once you get it, it's like the light bulb goes off. And I'm hoping what happens is that the light bulb goes off quickly. Light bulb goes on. Thank you, Steve. Yes. I don't want to turn any light bulbs off. I want to talk about some evidence for intelligent design. And, I was going to hand the flyers out after class, but you already have them, so you have all my answers. So don't look at them. Seriously. What I want to do is try to think this through with the class, kind of as I processed it. Hugh likes to get up here and tell you all the stuff he knows, and I want to try to do it a little bit differently. What I want you to do is help me think it through. So, first thing I want to do is read a letter. This letter, I found it on the internet. It's a letter to the editor of a newspaper called The Mountain Enterprise, which is in Western Antelope Valley up by Lancaster Palmdale, and it was written January 9th. I don't know what it was a response to, but you'll get the idea of the letter. Here's the letter. There really isn't any question from either a religious or scientific point of view that life and living systems reflect the presence of intelligent, complex, observable patterns or designs. From a scientific point of view, it is now understood that living systems are self-regulating, self-organizing, and capable of self-generating novel structures and behavior. Research scientists around the world from a variety of fields have contributed to the recognition of this self-organizing, self-generating, and self-regulating nature of life. At this point, there is no evidence that this intelligent design occurs outside the laws of nature and science, however. Rather, it appears that it is fully within the laws of nature and science. But should one choose to believe that a designer outside of nature designed the intelligence within nature, it's their right to do so. But then it would be based on faith or presupposition, not science. Okay, we've seen these kind of things a million times. We see it in the popular press, this idea that somehow matter, nature, self-organizes and comes up with all the complexity that we see in the world around us and in biology. Think about the terms, I want to go back to the terms that this writer used. Presence of intelligent, complex, observable patterns or designs. And then in another line, self-regulating, self-organizing, and capable of self-generating. Okay. We know from listening to Hugh that this isn't true. But why? Is there some easy way to get a hold of this and answer this argument? And that's what I want to do today. Let's start by talking about the characteristics of things that have been designed. Now here's where I want you to think about this. Don't look at my notes. And my cell phone. Now, if I ask you which one of these has been directly designed by natural processes and which one was the result of human design, obviously, you're going to tell me the cell phone was designed. The rock is a product of natural processes. Now, here's the question. How do you know? And I'm opening up this to the class. It's not a rhetorical question. Give me... That's right, you're right, but how can you tell? How can you tell? What's the difference between the rock and the cell phone? Okay. Okay. That's excellent, and that's one of my reasons. Okay, Mary? Okay, reason. That's actually my reason number four. Yeah, if they don't talk back, you ought to try it. It's great. I didn't say that. Complex electrical parts and mechanisms. That's number four. So you're right. This doesn't have an rock, and natural systems do not have any electrical systems. Okay, what else? John? Excellent. Okay, that is number five, material is in unnatural forms and shapes. Okay, take a look at this cell phone. There are some basic shapes, basic geometric shapes that you will find in nature. You'll find circles. If you're in outer space and you look at the Earth, it's a circle. You'll find spheres, raindrops falling. Again, if you're in outer space, the planets are basically in spherical shapes. But will you find this shape anywhere in nature? Probably not. Okay. Okay, what else? Lee. Okay, number one. Things that are designed serve a purpose. Mostly. Now, some of these you're going to find some holes in, and I know that, but my goal here is to go through the whole list and try to make an argument from the whole list. Okay, what else? What else does the cell phone have? Yes. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Last one, number nine. Yeah. Well, it contains information. Good answer. What else? Doug. Okay. Yes, that's true, and it's not one of mine on the list, so it can be. Well, yeah, okay. Go ahead. What else, John? but not precisely. You can break this in half, you can double the size, you can change the molecular content of it, you can change the shape, and it's still a rock. Jackie? Yes. Right. And also, yes, that's true. That's true. Okay. What else? Right. Well, that's number five, basically, that it's material is in unnatural forms and shapes. Okay? Natalie. Can you think of anything in nature that is a straight line? Well, it bends according to gravity. Okay, that's a good example. Yeah, that is. Mm-hmm. I can't argue specifically what you're saying. My guess is the shapes of some of the things that we produce, a square, for example, can you find a square in nature? You can find a hexagon in a crystal, but can you find a square? Okay. There may be. John? Okay. Okay. What else? Janet? Good. That's number three, complex mechanical parts. Yes. Yes. No, I haven't. Well, I haven't seen it, but let's talk about it afterwards. Yes. That's right, and I'm getting there. Okay, does anybody else have any other ideas, or I can fill you in with my ideas? Steve, you're not saying anything. I'm surprised. Okay, huh? Okay, number two on my list, and if you want to look at your notes now, you can at least look at the first section of them. The cell phone and man-made design things have integrated parts, parts that operate together that wouldn't operate by themselves. If you remove one of the parts, it's an integrated system. You have complex mechanical parts, complex electrical parts. Material is in unnatural forms and shapes. The material is in unnatural concentrations or requires complex manufacturing processes. There's nothing in nature that will give us plastic. There's nothing in nature that will give us some of the pure metals that are required in the alloys in the electronic parts. There's nothing in nature that will give us a clear screen. There's nothing in nature that will give us these buttons, for example. So the material is in unnatural concentrations or requires complex manufacturing process. One that I'm surprised nobody got is things that are designed, and not always, but often serve an aesthetic purpose. They look nice. Somebody could have built this phone with parts sticking out of the side and little things hanging off and paid no attention to the aesthetics and how it looked, and it would have worked just as well, and nobody would have bought it because it's ugly. I'm getting there. Yes, Jack. Okay. Yes, they do. That's true. Now, I'm not saying that things that aren't designed don't serve a purpose. I'm saying that things that are designed generally do serve a purpose. Jackie? Yes. Right. Now it's a. Okay, go ahead. No, that's a good distinction, and it's one we need to make. We can account for this rock by purely natural processes. Now, we also believe that God created the natural processes. Okay, so when I say things like this is directly created by natural processes, that's what I mean by that. Okay, it means that we can account for it by purely natural processes, even though we believe the natural processes were set up and devised by God in the first place. But we can't account for this being created strictly by natural processes. Natalie? Yes. Yes. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's where we're headed. Yes, sir. I think that's a good question, and I hadn't thought about it that way. Do you want to comment on that? Mm-hmm. Think of function as something active. Purpose as maybe not necessarily active. So I could imagine somebody paints a painting and hangs it on the wall. It has a purpose, but does it have a function? Maybe that's part of the distinction that you're talking about. Okay. All right. Aesthetic purposes. Contains information. Excellent answer. And the last one that I have is that the cell phone can do information processing. Calculator, computer. The information inside is processed. There's things done with the information by the machinery, by the circuitry inside the cell phone. Okay. Now, let's go to the next question. How many of those characteristics that you see on the sheet there apply to living organisms? Apply to the biological world? As far as I can tell, every single one. Now, some people would say that some of the animals aren't very good looking, but I think overall we have to admit that the biological world is amazingly beautiful, beautiful place. Okay, now, in addition to these features that we've talked about, there's several characteristics of life that are not attainable by even the best human design. Can anybody think of things that, what can biological systems, biological machines, basically is what, in a sense, what they are, what are some things that they can do that the best man-made machines can't do? Well, we can't. Right, okay. Reason. Excellent, and animals can reason also. Good, what else? Yes? What about trees? Right. Okay. That's excellent. Okay. Machines do not self-replicate. And I want to say something interesting about this self-replication. Each organism can reproduce. But not only can an organism reproduce, but every subparticle of the organism, the cell, every cell of every organism has what's in it called DNA, which is what? It's a complete set of instructions on how to build a new organism. It would be just like if you went to Target and bought a toaster, and every part on the toaster, every screw, every wire, had a complete set of instructions for building a toaster factory. It's a pretty amazing thing when you think about it. It's unbelievably complex, and it's information laden to sell. Okay, what else can living organisms do that the best man-made machines can't do? Anybody think of anything? That's part of thinking and processing. Yes. Okay. Natalie? Excellent. The way I put it is organisms locate and refine their own raw material. Okay. Organisms eat. They get rid of their waste. All of that is done automatically. Man-made machines require constant input of energy. Okay. David? Mm-hmm. That's part of that. That's right. Yes. Let me go through the list. Error correction. Now, we're just getting to this with computers, but the genetic code in living systems has an error correction capability. If there's certain kinds of mutations, if they happen, they become neutral mutations because there's an error correction capability in the organism that takes care of it, and it's not passed on to the next generation. And that's a mechanical system as well as a information system. No, some of the time. I mean, there are some mutations that are detrimental or fatal. Organisms are self-repairing. They heal themselves. You get a cut, it heals itself under the right circumstances. What mechanical things that we build can heal themselves? That's right. A kick. Yes, that's true. That's right. When the cell phone doesn't work, just throw it. And then sometimes it works. There's another one I came up with is that they're self... Yeah, John. Old science fiction story idea. I read that 30 years ago by Arthur Clarke or one of those guys, so you know where a lot of the best ideas come from. Yeah. Self-guiding. Once a biological organism gets going, it doesn't particularly need any direction or instruction on what to do. It just does its thing by itself. It collects the food, excretes the waste, and it has a knowledge or an intuition of what to do. Another one is that it can defend itself. What human machine can defend itself against attack? And then the others are just quantitative differences, the ones I came up with. They're way more complex than anything we can come up with. They're more energy efficient. There's less energy wasted in a biological system than is wasted in any man-made machine. And the size, we're just now getting to the point where we can do these things called nanotechnology, where we can go in with these tiny little pair of tweezers and a tiny little pair of pliers and design these tiny little machines. But where is our inspiration for doing that? It's from the natural world, the things that already exist, these micro machines. I want to give you an idea of the size of how much you can fit into a biological system. This time it's in terms of information. 1 cubic centimeter. How big is a centimeter? Anybody tell me? It's about 3/8 of an inch. Okay, so a cubic centimeter would be about the size of one of those small dice. Not the big ones, but the tiny ones. Okay? That much DNA can hold as much information as 1 trillion CDs. 750 terabytes of information. Now, any of these characteristics by themselves, especially taken together, okay, that we talked about, human character, the characteristics of human machines that compare to nature's machines, and the characteristics that nature's machines has that we can't reproduce, all of those characteristics put together are evidence for design. Yes. I can give you a very educated answer. I don't know. How's that? No, I don't. I wouldn't want to comment on that. Yeah, and I don't know. Now, out of all those features, the one that I want to focus on and I want to spend most of the rest of the talk talking about is information. Somebody give me a definition of information. Anybody want to take a stab at it? Yeah, you've been very brave today. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, that's a good answer. That's excellent. That's an excellent answer. What else? Anybody come up with a definition? Anybody want to be on the hot seat here? Yes. That's right. Just look at the internet. Okay. All right. Mary, would you write this on the board? Write it. Right, yeah, that's fine. My favorite number is 4. No, it's not, but just for the purpose of this, it is. Yes. It's a good example of what I'm going to talk about. Okay. Does the information that's conveyed to you by those different ways of writing it, does it change? It does. But the entity that's represented, the 4 that is represented doesn't change. Okay. So, yes, Lee. Leave it to you. So, the information is independent of the way I wrote it, right? Now, where's the 4? Alright, let's look at that sentence. My favorite number is 4. How many different ways can I communicate that to you? I wrote it on the chalkboard. I could speak it. I could do, excellent, I could do sign language. I could send it to you in an email. I could do charades. Okay, excellent, excellent. I could write it in chalk on the sidewalk. I could hire an airplane and have it sky written across the sky. I could send you an email. I could say it over the radio. Okay? But the message is the same. The information stays the same. So what is, now I'm going to ask you again, what is information? Steve? Right. Okay. And your first thing you said is close to where I'm going. So the point is that the message, the medium, is not the message. Okay. The message can be conveyed in an endless number of ways, and the message, my favorite number is 4, that sentence is communicated exactly the same in a whole lot of different ways. Right. 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 And even where did I put it?
Even if you have some
the message is still the same. Okay, now let's look at it the other way.
Paper and ink.
The chemical elements in this newspaper are the same day after day, week after week. But the message, the information in the newspaper is never the same. So, the message is not the medium, and the medium is not the message. Okay? So, we're back to one thing Steve said is, here's another thing that information is not, which will give you a bit of a clue. Information represents something other than itself. Okay? That chalk on that board is not the statement, my favorite number is 4, but it represents that. It represents that little bit of information. Okay? So again, I ask you, what is information? Let me give you the... I struggled with this for a long time, so I don't expect you guys to come up with it. Go ahead, give it a shot. I'm not sure there's a good definition. It's one of those things that we all know what it is, but coming up with an excellent definition of it is going to be tough. And I took a shot at it, and if you guys want to poke holes in it, John? Yeah. Right. Yeah, but I'm talking about the piece of information that's behind the code. In this case,
number 4, whatever that is, it's the information piece that is the number 4 that's represented by all the situations, not something that can be interpreted or...
Right. Okay, excellent. Here's what I came up with. This is, information is a representation of an idea or thought or concept or knowledge which can be transmitted by a specified sequence of symbols. Okay, now why do I say specified sequence of symbols? Because you can't just throw a bunch of random letters onto the newspaper or onto the computer screen or onto the chalkboard and come up with my message. Likewise, no natural law can control the message. If it was a natural law, you would come out with either the same letter every time or some kind of pattern or a nonsense set of complex symbols. Okay, so it has to be specified. But it's not, information is not matter, it's not energy. There's a really good quote, I couldn't find it, but the scientist said basically that information is a third kind of thing that must have existed from the beginning of the universe. It's not matter, it's not energy, but it definitely does exist. All right, here's another stumper for you. I have 3 places that I came up with. Where does information come from? Well, you're close. Dig deeper. Where does information come from? Dig deeper. I'm looking for 3 very general ways that we can create, that information can be created in this universe that we live in. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thought. The third answer that I have is a mind. A mind that can freely choose the symbols needed to convey the information. Okay, that's number three. Number one is you can get information from another informed system. I can get information out of my cell phone because the cell phone can process or simply duplicate information that's already in there. Okay? I can get information out of a book because a book already has information put into it. I can get information out of my TV, out of my computer. You get the idea. Okay? Now, what is there in nature that already has information in it that reproduces information? Other than living organisms, there aren't any, but living organisms is a great example. When you see the little weed growing up out of the sidewalk, and it just looks like life happens everywhere, but we know that that weed came from a seed, the seed came from another plant, came from seed ad infinitum back millions of years until the first plant of that species was imbued somehow with the information content that allowed the whole thing to wind up and get going. Okay? Now the third place that information can come from, or at least people say it can come from, is chance, random chance. Now, if we had a random generator that produced, on a computer screen, that produced random letters, if we looked at the screen, we would find small, short words. Okay, we would probably see cat, or dog, or it, or might even see a four-letter word, face, something like that. Give it enough time and you'll come up with stuff like that. So, random chance can come up with small bits of data. Lee? How so? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we have other informed systems, chance, and a mind. Now, this sentence up here, my favorite number is 4. How did I construct that sentence? Think about the process. Yes, sir. Exactly, and that's where I'm going. That's why we're going to cross it off the list here pretty quick. Yes. My favorite number is 4. How did I construct that sentence? I did it by using a language that represents symbols that we all understand. I constructed the sentence one letter at a time to make one word at a time to make the sentence that represents my thought. And that's what you're talking about. Now, why am I spending all this time on information, what it is and where it comes from? Right, and that's where I'm headed. So, good. Okay, let's go back to talking about biology. Let's talk about the smallest life form, the life form that we know of that has the smallest genetic code. Now, what is a genetic code? DNA is the molecule inside every cell of every living organism that is the instructions for reproduction of that organism. But what is it actually? How does it work? There are four chemicals inside the DNA double helix that account for the information. Adenine, cytosine, guanine, thymine. they act exactly like four different letters in an alphabet. If you have an alphabet that consists of four letters, okay, that is literally how the DNA is written. It is a code. It is a piece of information just like this talk that I'm giving, just like my sentence up there. Okay? Now, the smallest organism, the organism with the smallest genetic code that we know of is a bacteria. And it has, it's called Pelagibacter ubique. It has the smallest genome that we know of. And that genome consists of about 1,309,000 base pairs. And the base pairs represent the letters. Okay? So it would be like a book with 1,309,000 characters in it, in this four-letter alphabet that we are talking about. Okay? So I got to thinking about it. If Hugh would give you this fact, he would come up with some number like the odds of this happening by natural causes are 1 × 10⁻⁷ or something like that. Well, I wanted to give you something a little more concrete, a little more easy to understand. Okay? So I went over to my bookshelf and I thought, well, where can I find a book that's about this, that has about this many characters in it? So I took my calculator out and figured out how many letters there are on a page. And ironically, Charles Darwin, Origin of Species has slightly fewer letters in it than the smallest bacteria that we know of. Isn't that ironic? That the very thing that he couldn't account for, chemical, biological information, is one of the biggest arguments against his argument. Now, this bacteria is approximately the same size as what we think the first living organism probably looked like. Now, there's some variation in that. I don't want to say that there's not. If you took all the... If you took... Yeah, John. Much more complicated. Yes. You're right. You're right. If you took this book and changed some of the punctuation, ran some of the words together, got rid of the spaces, changed some of the spelling, rearranged some of the words, you might even be able to rearrange some of the paragraphs, you would still get the meaning out of this book. And likewise, there is some variation in the organization of the DNA in bacteria and all living systems. But the general idea is the same. You have, if you're going to account for the information content in the simplest organism, which is similar to what we think is the very first organism that existed on Earth, if you're going to account for that by naturalistic processes, you have to, it's more likely that that information content would come about by itself than this, the contents of Darwin's book would come about by itself, with your exception, I understand. Okay, but that's an idea of the scale of the information, the amount of information that we're talking about in the very simplest organism. Now, in a human DNA, there's about 3 billion base pairs. So you're looking at about 2,588 copies of Origin of Species. Okay, that's how much information is in the human DNA in every cell, in every human being. Okay, for as a comparison, about 2,588 copies. Now, this argument also works. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and go ahead. I agree with you, and it's a completely different topic. We love to bash methodological naturalism, the process by which scientists use to, they assume there is no God, they assume there is no supernatural anything going on to pursue their train of thought. And in many ways, that has been a very profitable way of thinking. So I agree with what you're saying. We can't abandon that. And many times in the past, people of faith have said too quickly that we haven't, the explanation for this is supernatural. But that doesn't mean that we don't ever get to say that. And I don't really want to go there because it's not what I'm doing here, but I agree with what you're saying. John? Yes, that's right. And to be fair, he did not try to account for the origin of life. Yeah. My understanding is that the ones that are lower than that are not, they cannot survive on their own. They're virus-like. And they attach themselves to, right, they have to have a host. That's right. That's right. John, you want to comment on that? Right. Right. That's right. But the base pairs are equivalent to the letters in the alphabet. Okay. My analogy with using a book to represent biological information can be taken one step further. How many times, Hugh has mentioned this sometimes, how many times have you heard the argument that species A evolved into species B? And we know this, scientists talking, because the genetic code in species A is 97% the same as the code in species B. Now, we intuitively know, not necessarily, but what's a good analogy we can use to refute that? And I've got one, I think. I've got the 9th edition of Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, published in 85, okay? I also have the 10th edition of Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, published 10 years later in 95. Now let's assume for my argument that there's a difference of 3% in information in these two volumes. Okay? Now would anybody say that the 3% that was changed from volume 9 into volume 10 was chosen randomly? I'm sure there are things in here that have been deleted. There are things that have been added. There are probably some definitions which have been changed, which changed or were worded slightly different over the 10 years between the two publications of these books. But what did it take to make that change? It took somebody looking at it and thinking about it and making those deletions and those additions and those changes thoughtfully. They had to think about it. There's no way to account even for a small difference between one and the other by any kind of random choices. And that's a good analogy to use for difference between two organisms. Again, somebody had to think about it. And that's really the basis for my argument. Okay. Yeah. That's right. That's right. That each one was designed, created for its own purpose. That's right. John? Right. John, one of the examples that I had, and I must have just missed it in my notes when we were talking about the complexity of the simplest single-cell organism. To give you another good analogy on how you can compare the complexity of that little tiny machine that we can't even see, not only do you have the informational side in the DNA, but just the complexity of the machine itself is roughly on a par with an automobile or a home computer. Okay, so you're talking about something that sophisticated, that complicated, with that many integrated parts. You have to account for the original construction of that machine in the first place. Okay, but that's an idea of how complicated it is. Thank you for reminding me on that. Yes. I've heard that, and I didn't run into it in my research for this, so I'm not going to make that claim. I'll just talk about the complexity of the DNA. Okay, now, one more distinction I want to make. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to wrap up. But afterwards, I want to address exactly that. Okay. Let's talk about the difference between two things. I want to talk about the difference between information, which we've spent a lot of time on, and order. Okay. Can somebody give me a definition for order? Yeah, it's repetitive, it's patterned, it has symmetry, it has repetition. You can line things up in a row. Now, is order the same as information? No, it's not at all. Can somebody give me some examples of some things in nature that are highly ordered but have very little information content? Mm-hmm. Excellent example. Okay. Let me show you the one that I can. Okay. They're incredibly complex. But if you take water in the clouds at particular temperatures under certain circumstances, you will always get snowflakes. There's very little information content in a snowflake, even though they're all different and they're all very sophisticated. Okay, orbital patterns of planets around stars. It looks sophisticated, but the amount of information that goes in there is actually pretty simple. Okay, so there are many patterns in nature that are ordered, but they don't require any instruction. Okay. And that's another distinction and another talk, but you're right, Arlene. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right, that's right. All right, I want to give you an example of those of you who are computer literate will get a kick out of this. This is a pattern that's produced. Thank you to David for producing this on the computer. This is something I read about years ago called a Mandelbrot set. Mandelbrot was a mathematician that figured this out, and the Mandelbrot set is the set of numbers he uses to generate this. What this is you take there's a very simple mathematical equation, and you plug that equation into this computer program, and it gives you these patterns. Now, here's the amazing thing. It's a fractal, and what that means is that on the computer, if you took any spot on this fractal design and blew it up, you would have another pattern. And then take any part of that design and blew it up and you would have another pattern. It's infinitely regressive. It goes on and on and on. No matter how close you zoom in on it, the pattern, there's this incredibly complex pattern, but they're always different. And likewise, if you take this one and step back figuratively in the computer and look at the bigger picture, this is but a smaller part of a bigger pattern. And you step back from that, and it's a smaller part of a bigger pattern, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. So if you're interested in this, just do a Google on Mandelbrot set, and there's a bunch of generators where you can do these. It's really very cool. But the point is, this is a very simple mathematical formula that produces this unbelievable complexity. So here's a really good example of something with high complexity, high order, and very low information content. Okay, John, I need to hold off because I just want to get through it. Okay, so if somebody, let's go back to that letter that we started with. Somebody asks, how do you account for the information content in the DNA in natural processes? And somebody appeals to order, like that letter did. What's your answer? Answer is they're not the same. Order and information are two different things. And if you go away with anything from this talk, go away with this. When people talk about order, self-ordering systems in nature, there are things that self-order. Snowflakes, crystals, on a computer, the Mandelbrot set, but it is not the same as information. If it would be like somebody saying, how come the moon orbits around the sun? And your response is, because water boils at 212 degrees. Okay? It's a non sequitur. You're answering a question that wasn't asked. Okay? So now, let's go back to this letter with a little bit better ear. Okay? There really isn't any question from either a religious or scientific point of view that life and living systems reflect the presence of intelligent, complex, observable patterns or designs. You hear it? He's appealing to intelligence and at the same time observable patterns and designs that are complex. Okay? He's right. The letter is a woman, actually. She's right in that there are things that are ordered in nature that can be accounted for by natural processes. There is nothing in nature that can account for the information content of DNA. Let me give you a couple more
individually.
Somewhere is my snowflake. Okay. We've got four examples now. We've got a rock, which at least on a macro level is low order, low information content. Pretty simple. Okay. We've got a snowflake. Snowflake is highly ordered, but no information. On the other end of the spectrum, we've got a newspaper. Newspaper is fairly low order, but it's high in information content. And then at the top is the cell phone, which is highly ordered, highly information content. Now, which of these items can be accounted for by natural processes? The ordered system and the rock. Which ones cannot be accounted for by natural processes? The ones that contain information. Okay? And I would say the analogy holds to biological systems. It comes down to a question of philosophy. It's not a question of science. Those who hold this view would say it comes down to a question of common sense, which is this. Can the idea of information in the first place, which is symbolic, and the information and the information itself come from any blind mechanistic process? Or must it come from, as the word information implies, must it come from an informed source? Those who hold this position would say that information or knowledge or data or ideas can only be created by a free will being who can choose each symbol and choose the method of communication. And the DNA is just as much a message or code or piece of communication as this talk that I'm giving. Another way of putting it, is it possible to give something meaning without a mind? Now, we believe that the best explanation for the message, for the code, in the DNA in the first living organisms is the Creator God of the Bible. And there's one verse that came to mind while I was doing this that really just, it put new meaning in this verse as I went through this. And it's Psalms 139, starting at 13. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. It's a couple of quotes. You might want to ask how, what do scientists think about this question? I got a couple of really good quotes. The first one is by a gentleman named Bernd Olaf Kuipers, and he's quoted in one of the books that I used, but I could not find out what his position is, but I'll read you the quote. He says, "The problem of the origin of life is clearly basically equivalent to the problem of the origin of biological information." And David Baltimore, who many of you may know the name, he's a Nobel laureate and president of Caltech, he said, "Modern biology is a science of information." So, people are aware of this issue. That's basically my talk. I want to say thank you publicly to some people that really helped me on this. I couldn't have done this without several lunch and dinner conversations and sweating through this stuff. So, I want to say thank you to Paul Pothier and Mark Perez and Rich Deem and John Traeger and David Briniger and my wife, Mary Hoagland. So, thank you, everybody.